Hello and welcome to episode 77 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, and Chris Weston.
Well, hi, Matt, and it is, as you say, episode 77. Aren't we lucky to have got this far?
Yes. It's another double figures. Only 11 more until the next one.
It's good that they happen with such regularity.
Oh, isn't it just? It's yeah. How has your week been? Didn't you organise some sort of get together for technologists in the Midlands this week?
Ah, yes, of course. And I was looking forward to mentioning that. So we had our first meetup for the Midlands Tech Leaders Group, and I thought that there was definitely a possibility it would just be two of us gazing into each other's eyes over a table in a pub in Birmingham. But actually, it was very well attended. We had a lot of people turn up, a lot of introductions made, and jollity, as can only happen on a Friday after work in the pub. And I hope that we will grow from that and we get a bit more, a few more people into it. It was really good. I really enjoyed it.
Excellent. That sounds like good fun. It's doing the first one. I have to say, from personal experience, the first one is a lot of hard work. It's great to be able to get everybody there. It's the second one where no bugger turns up. That's really hard.
Absolutely, yeah, that's right. Because everybody's been, and I said, "Oh yeah, I know all those people. I'm not going again." Yeah,
exactly. It's,
was it the Free Rangers? Was it last year or the year before?
Oh, it's 3 or 4 years ago now. I think that we did. We had 3 meetups. The first we had about 40 people turn up for, and then it was about a dozen for the second, and it was about 9 for the third. And at that point, it kind of fizzled out. It's really hard to sustain beyond the first meeting. And it's quite a bit discouraging because you go, oh, it's going to be brilliant after the first one. So, I'm pouring water on it, but the second one's really hard.
I was quite excited about that, and now you've discouraged me. Now, I think the good news about this is a little bit like the WB40 WhatsApp group. We have a WhatsApp group for this one, and I think that kind of sustains it, really, in terms of the conversation and whatever. And if people want to get together, then they get together. And if you do it every now and again as a group, that's great. But it doesn't necessarily have to in order for people to chat.
Yeah, that makes a huge difference. And it was something we never got going online. It must have been about 3 years ago, the Free Rangers thing, because WhatsApp wasn't quite in complete ascendance as it is now. And so we didn't have that channel, and so we tried it on Slack and we tried it on LinkedIn. Oh god, LinkedIn groups, there's a place for ideas to die. And as a result, it didn't have that thing sustaining it between meetings. And I think that actually, if you've got that going already, then that's probably a big help.
Yeah, so because certainly the podcast WhatsApp group is brilliant, isn't it? It's one of the things that keeps us going, I would say.
Yeah, I'd agree. Ideas for the show, and also the connections that are being made between people through it is really good. So if you want to get involved in it, we used to have it as an open thing, but we had too many people, mostly from Eastern Europe, trying to sell sexual services. So we had to not have a public link to it. But just drop us a line on Twitter or an email or whatever, medium gets your fancy, and we can send you a link to be able to join up to the WhatsApp group. And interesting, diverse conversations are always going on there.
And this week, it's only the return of yin and yang. Oh. Seems like forever.
I know, what it is. It's been months. Month, literally, has been months, but we're back.
So this week is your turn, and you're going to restart this. What should we call it? It's a tradition now, yin and yang. It's a traditional item of this show. It's got hair on it, so it's something that everybody's been looking forward to its return.
A regular feature. So this week's yin is something I've been meaning to blog about for ages, but really haven't had the time, what with having to remake the theme tune for the show and stuff. So the specific thing is that video that was around and about a few years ago now about a turtle that had got a plastic straw up its nose, and the video was of this straw being very painfully removed from the poor little turtle's nostrils. And I don't have a problem with turtles. I don't have a problem with them being made better when they're being assaulted by bits of disposable plastic. I don't have a problem in principle with the idea of trying to be able to cut back on disposable straws. But what I am increasingly getting concerned about is that we're heading into another situation a bit like that with diesel cars. There's an obsessive following at the moment around the idea of cutting back on single-use plastic packaging and single-use plastic other stuff like straws. And that's a really, really good aim. But the thing that I'm concerned about is we're focusing too much on plastic and not enough on the real problem, which is single use. Now, thought experiment for you. Buy 2 bottles of water. Now, then feel bad about yourself for buying bottles of water. Then drink the water, but one of the bottles needs to be a plastic bottle and the other one needs to be a glass bottle. With your now empty bottles, feel the weight of them. Notice that the glass bottle is a lot heavier than the plastic one. And there's a reason why plastic bottles have become so popular. And one of the reasons is because they're really, really, really light, which means it takes very little resource to be able to ship them around. So you're minimising freight transportation costs and all the rest. Now, the second part of this, find a hard surface and drop both bottles on the floor whilst you're barefoot and then walk away. This is the other problem with glass. It's incredibly dangerous because it gets broken and then turns into nasty, sharp fragments of stuff that cause damage, whereas plastic just bounces. Now, I'm not saying that plastic bottles are a good thing. What I am saying is that if we obsess about the plastic and we lose sight of the single-use thing, we run the significant risk of ending up as we have done with thinking about carbon emissions but not thinking about other emissions, and having our cities clogged with diesel vehicles that have been subsidised really heavily that may be low carbon but are very good at pushing out sulphur and all sorts of other things.
This sounds like an internet yang, which is an excuse for a moan about people trying to do their best for the planet. And this turtle has done nothing more than, you know, it's a bit of a celebrity now, isn't it?
Well, this is the point.
A celebrity.
Yeah, but this is the thing, isn't it? That turtle, that little tiny cute in pain turtle, actually, the link on the website, you can see this, had a huge role in raising awareness of single-use plastic, and that's brilliant, and not great for the turtle. But as I say, the thing that I just see us heading headlong towards is replacing single-use plastic with single-use something else, which is just as bad or even worse, rather than really addressing it. Exactly.
It does happen, and we need to be aware of that, as you say. Everybody's putting plastic straws in their restaurants now, aren't they?
Paper straws, rather.
So that'll be a good demonstration of whether that makes any difference or not. Would the streets be strewn with paper straws that we have to clean up? I don't know. I would say the plastic bag rule, that seems to have made a difference, hasn't it?
That's actually a good example of where this has worked, because actually what's happened is not we've replaced plastic bags with paper bags or some sort of other bag. People are now reusing bags, and they're doing that much more reliably. And that's a good thing. That's what we need to be heading towards with this stuff about single-use plastic. It's about
not glass bags.
Not no, glass bags. Disastrous. So anyway, there's that.
Go on, the chest.
So the other side of it, the yang, is a lovely little thing that I picked up on last week's Web Curios, which is the weekly email newsletter from Imperica, which if you don't subscribe to it, you should, because it's fabulous. Huge amount of work goes into it every week. Why I don't know, but it's, you know, it's great. And the thing on there is a thing called webdesignmuseum.org, and all it is screenshots of web pages over the years, and it's lovely. It's fascinating when you start to look at quite how much the web has evolved, and we forget, because in the 90s in particular it looked rather ropey. It's quite cute but ropey. So anyway, Web Design Museum, just a fabulous way to spend half an hour or so.
I'll add to that. There's a page today that I noticed, the Digitizer website. And Digitizer is the website run by somebody who used to work on the Channel 4 teletext page of the same name. It was called 14 Ways Our Ancient Ancestors Attempted to Explain What the Internet Was. So I recommend that as well. So that, we can put that link alongside yours on the webpage.
Fantastic. WB40podcast.com, and you can get all that linky goodness.
So this week we are lucky enough to have another interview.
Hooray.
And that's, yeah, hooray. That's with Neil Usher. And we've talked about workplaces on several podcasts previously, haven't we? And this is about the elemental workplace.
Yes. So Neil's written a book called The Elemental Workplace, which he describes 12 key elements that he thinks need to be combined together to be able to produce a successful physical workplace, office space or whatever else. So rather than just asking him about his book, what we did was we looked at all of the elements in the context of, do these apply to purely digital workplaces? So if you think of something like Slack, and rather than thinking of it as an information repository, but think of it as a digital workplace, a place where people go to work, how does that stand up if you analyse it through the light of how Neil has analysed the physical workplace? So that's what's coming up. To start off with, though, I just asked Neil a little bit about how the book came about.
Going to a lot of conferences, listening to case studies about organisations that have taken workplace seriously, invested very heavily, and seem to be disappearing into a distant orbit, leaving the vast majority of people with pretty mediocre, unengaging, unimaginative spaces where their organisations didn't necessarily feel that their working environment was especially important in all of their lives. Thinking there must be something at the core of what we could do for organisations that doesn't involve substantial investment but makes a huge difference. So, what is the most we could possibly do with the smallest amount of money, effectively, to create a better working environment? So focusing on the things that are important. I then took it out and roadshowed it and tested it with a number of different groups. Instead of, if I went to do a talk at a conference, instead of presenting this back to people and saying, here are the 10 elements you should focus on, I just had two sort of blank pieces of paper. I said, let's work out what we think the important ones are over here. And on this other piece of paper, let's put the things that are kind of interesting and useful to have, but aren't necessarily what we regard as core. And just about every one of those exercises arrived at a very similar list. Mm-hmm. And I tested it with HR folk and with property people, workplace people, and sort of general management audiences as well. And I thought, there's something in this. There's something that keeps telling me the same things. And discussions with the publisher suggested that, of all the things in my blog, what is it that's been bothering me the most over the years? What's the thing that I'm most interested in? And I could never really get away from this, that there was something we could do quickly, easily, anywhere in the world, any work style, any business sector, any culture, any location. Was there something and an approach that was completely transferable? And that's what I wanted to try and create, was a useful frame of reference for anyone in this business at all to think about improving the workplace. And if we could just get a few of those workplaces improved, it would have been worthwhile.
So let's step through them and then just see how maybe they would apply to digital workplaces. So let's start at the top then. So daylight in the physical workplace, I think that's fairly...
Yeah, there was an article published yesterday in Harvard Business Review saying, daylight is the most important thing in the workplace. Yes, I explored that and just pretty much came top. Every time I did this as an interactive session, it was the thing that most people really latched onto and found the most important. So I think if we think of that in terms of a digital space, just touch on space and place for a moment, because I've wrestled with this quite a lot. There's a friend of mine, Ian Ellison, who writes a lot about and practices a lot in workplace circles, and we've often talked about space and place. And I think I landed on a very simple way of looking at it, which is that space is unoccupied, and the minute you add people to that space, it becomes a place. Doesn't necessarily always mean it's a successful place or it's a harmonious or collaborative place, but people plus the space makes the place. And that applies in digital space as well. So the tools we create, if we created a sort of a Slack community but no one had actually used it yet, you've created a space, the people start interacting, and that then creates a digital place. So daylight's quite an interesting one in terms of a sort of a functional digital place, because I think you can be a little bit more abstract with what that means in terms of sort of there being light in that digital place and it feeling, creating, because one of the things daylight does is it creates an optimism and a sense of purpose and a sense of some sort of degree of opportunity in that place. It makes us, it's a lot of the interesting research I found was from medical sources. Even Florence Nightingale was writing about this in the Crimean War about the healing process for patients who are exposed to a lot more daylight than others. So I think in a way, in a digital place, we're looking for there to be daylight, but it's not daylight in the way we would physically term it. It's daylight in a metaphorical sense, because it makes us feel that interacting freely with some degree of psychological safety is possible in that place.
So next up, connectivity. Now, this is a perennial problem in an awful lot of physical spaces.
Yeah. And I think the difficulty with a lot of property teams is they don't always have the best relations with the IT team in their organisation. And I've heard that many times, particularly since consulting, where I get to meet a lot more people than I probably used to. But the frustrations instantly arise. You know, the minute you mention the need to sit technology at the heart of your approach to workplace, oh, I can't do that. You know, we won't really get on with those guys over there. I think this underpins digital space, the freedom to connect at will and to exercise one's judgment in connecting or not connecting. From a technological point of view, that has to be seamless and has to work 100% of the time and be intuitive and be easy and be natural in that process as well.
And also something that I see frequently at the moment is where organisations are moving into cloud-based software, so particularly Office 365. There's a kind of behind-the-firewall mentality to security that still thinks of systems and services as things that need to be restricted from the outside world.
Yes.
And so, by default, many organisations implement things like 365 and don't allow people to share documents outside of their own organisation, even though they'll be allowed to send emails outside their organisation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that, for me, that connectivity beyond the organisation is something that I think a lot of information security people are really struggling with, because the underlying models for security have fundamentally changed, and it's not... You don't need to do it like you used to.
Yeah, and they've mirrored physical security as well. You know, erecting huge buildings in city centres and putting access control on the front door. So there's no connection with the community unless people actually leave the building you've just built. And that's pretty vital in that sense. So I think the more that we see co-working spaces, and the more that we see people mixing with all individuals from other organisations, and the more that corporates put people into these flexible spaces as well. I've seen some where there is still a front door with an access control on it and a reception desk and the logo above the desk, but there are still a lot of people from large corporates mixing with people from other organisations in physical space, like they would be in sort of public access digital space as well. And I think we're still really getting our head around is what does have to be kept secure and what can be shared without any real implications.
It also, when you're talking there, makes me think that maybe if we think about these ideas of analogies for services, maybe WhatsApp is the coffee shop of online collaboration, it's a place where everybody can go, so that's where we end up.
And I saw that I did a fair amount of work in Australia about sort of 6-7 years ago, and I was always amazed that I just spent my whole day going in and out of the building to the cafe on the street, a different cafe every time, because there's like in places like Brisbane, there's just about every shop in the street is a cafe. Virtually nobody had a meeting in the building.
So next one is space.
The space in the book really focuses on sort of what's the sort of kind of minimum levels, what are the maximum levels, and how do we sort of show that in a bell curve, and how do we think about it? It's one of those things you need to have an understanding of and agreed, and then you pretty much take it off the table once it's done. And the same in digital spaces. We don't want digital spaces that are utterly claustrophobic and force us to respond and force us to interact and then get upset when we don't interact and we don't take part. And I think one of the joys of certainly with something like Twitter in its early days was just sort of having the freedom to come and go, to be in that space or not be in that space, and just not worry about missing out, not worrying and not feeling under any pressure to actually say anything to anyone if you didn't want to. So I think space is applicable in a digital space too, and again it's that sort of metaphor of feeling comfortable enough to speak or not to speak, to interact or not to interact, and not to feel the pressure of the space closing in on you.
Next up, choice.
utterly vital. I mean, we've mentioned a number of tools in the time we've been talking before and after we switched the mic on, and I'm finding that a lot of people I interact with now are becoming a lot more discerning about the tools they do use and how they like to work. I don't think there are any that are sort of, you know, just ubiquitous in the sense that everybody's on them, you know, and if you're not on it, somehow you're missing out. So most people have got a core tool or two, and then a number of others that are around it that they'll check occasionally. And the difficulty is there's new tools and new spaces arriving all of the time. So how many of these do you choose to interact in? And I think it's important that we allow individuals to exercise the choice for what suits them best and what suits what they're trying to do. Choice has to be, you know, choice is not always the answer and is not always the upside. But in terms of physical workplace, choice is a little bit of a sort of get out of jail free card in a way. It actually helps to offset some of the problems that might occur with the other elements. Choice is the linchpin of that whole table in a way. So in respect of other elements like inclusion, you know, it could be that what is good for a lot of people isn't necessarily good for a small number of people, but the ability to exercise choice means they can always find a space that works for them and that does what it needs to do for them, even if a lot of other people are using different spaces you've created. And I think, you know, the same then applies in digital space as well. So I think whilst it's a vital element in all of this, it's not necessarily always a good thing and does need to be sort of managed in the right way.
Element number five is influence. And this is for people to have influence over their space
to create a relationship with it. And I think in digital tools, we've got the opportunity to set ourselves up, to create our profiles, to create the networks we want, to apply the filters we need to apply. I'm sure you've heard it, but the great answer to the sort of, you know, perennial problem of digital overload is we don't have a problem with that. We have a problem with our filtration, and you know, for as long as we've got better filters and we're able to set up our networks. Was fascinated by what Luis Suarez did, if you know Luis, in Twitter, where he stopped following everybody and just set up a whole series of lists. And he realised that actually he didn't have to follow anyone at all. If he just included in the right lists, the right subjects, he could just go to those lists and he could have a perfectly meaningful, you know, interaction with people and enjoy that space, but without sort of complying with the way that it was originally intended to. So he found a sort of a loophole. It's really interesting. He started following people again, but it was a really interesting experiment when he literally just sort of, you know, cleared it down. So we have the opportunity to influence digital space because we can choose how we use it. So choice and influence working in parallel, working together, where we're able to actually create the relationship with the tool.
That brings us onto control, which is probably quite closely tied to this. In the physical workspace?
In the physical, it's really about sort of thermal conditions, noise, you know, there's a number of factors in there where we feel, it's also part of, it's quite heavily linked to influence in terms of we feel we've got the ability to set our physical space up the way we want it to work for us. It's quite difficult in very large corporate centres where, you know, you are aggregated in terms of your needs and your preferences. And control then links to choice as well. So, you know, noise is the thing that in the Leisman surveys, which is the sort of the most commonly used survey tool in the business, constantly number one problem for most people in a workplace is noise. But if they have the ability to exercise choice or some control through exercising choice, they can work in a different place as long as it's available to get away from that noise.
And it's an area where I've become increasingly concerned that the outcome of agile software practice, which leads to what's known as evergreen software products, are actually removing control from people. The fact that things are constantly being tweaked by the developers, I think I described in a recent show as being like an exercise in mass gaslighting. Because I thought the thing that I was looking for was there, but it now appears to have moved. And is it because I don't know where I was looking, or is it because they've moved it? If you did that in the physical environment, you would drive people absolutely potty.
And Twitter's just notorious for that, isn't it? I mean, the day they changed, I can't remember what it used to be called, but it was a sort of bookmark function to a like.
Yes.
You know? And so people now use it as a like, as though they were using a different tool. And actually, I still use it as a bookmark. I'm coming back to that later, because that's what I remember its function being. And there was a lot of kerfuffle over the sort of 140 characters being doubled and people sort of up in arms about all that. And what's quite interesting, actually, is most people still use 140 characters because they're sort of quite habituated in that respect. But yes, it's the constant changes and then the uproar at every change, because there's always a group of people who don't like it and make a right song and dance about it, and it might be different groups of people, but yes, in a physical space, while we need to be very conscious that it will evolve and it will need to evolve with the changes in the business, those continual tweaks that have a fairly material functional impact, because most of these changes in digital space do change the way we're being asked to use the tool. Yeah. Whereas in a physical space, I think we've those little changes can be worked around quite easily. In a digital space, it's much harder to work around them, or you have to think a lot more about it, or something might have just disappeared.
Refresh is number 7.
That's really all about the kind of cafe culture that's emerged in a lot of sort of in particular in sort of developed economies, but pretty much everywhere, has really sort of changed the way we view that inside a physical space. You'd have had to have a lot of people and a lot of money several years ago to have even considered putting a cafe inside your building. You might have a canteen and industrial sort of facilities where you absolutely had to, but in an office building in the middle of town with plenty of opportunities to eat and drink outside, why would you invest in that? Whereas now it's almost an expectation. So we've moved in that direction along with the developments in the high street and our expectations around that. But I'm at pains to stress that it's those sort of spaces in a physical workplace where the silos break down, not because you put one team next to another team. It's the fact that people can go to another space in the building and they can have a different kind of conversation, and they can meet people that they're not necessarily working with, or they take their meetings there. So pure and simple, they just gather one another at the desk and then they go to another space like a refresh space. It's the social contribution that they're making that is just as important, if not more important, than the physiological contribution. So that's absolutely vital. I'm not entirely sure how that...
Well, I think for the digital workplace, I think it does. And it's actually, if you look over the history of IT tools for collaboration and communication in organisations, very often it's social use that is the trigger for people to be able to understand how to use it for business use. I've told this story many times before, but one of the big law firms in the early 90s, when email was first around, and the senior partners couldn't understand the value of this thing, so were very, very dismissive of it. And then there was a test match series, and somebody set up a list so they could email the up-to-date scores. And at the point when the senior partners realised they could continue to have a telephone conversation with a client and keep up to date the cricket, was the point at which they made the connection and were able to see how. Because often it's that kind of social use.
Yeah.
You know, social networks have been propagated into organisations, not because they started in organisations, but because they started outside. And yet organisations will often be very restrictive of the way in which people are able to use digital work spaces for non-work activity.
Yeah, it's funny, LinkedIn hasn't quite sort of bridged that gap there, has it really? It's still stuck in the sort of, you know, let's all pretend that we're at work sort of mode, really. And you see a little bit of the social creeping in reverse.
Usually followed up by a bunch of people saying, this isn't Facebook, you know.
And Twitter started as a... I mean, I was at pains in the early days of Twitter when there was virtually no one in the property industry on Twitter at all, I don't think. So I've explained, this isn't just fun. This is a business tool. I find stuff that I wouldn't find anywhere else. You know, I can set up the way that I use this, and it's a business tool. And people would look at me very skeptically, like, no, you're just wasting your time having a giggle with people. And it's like, no, I'm finding stuff that you won't find. Other than that, I'm finding events. I went to my first Connecting HR conference, because I saw some people talking about, it was the second one that was ever held, and I saw them talking about the first one and some film clips that people had made from the first one. I thought, that looks fantastic. I want to know more HRP workers. I want to broaden my networks. And, you know, I've made a number of friends through that sort of, you know, just getting off my backside and saying, do you mind if I come to the next one? I'm not an HR person, but I'm really interested in what you're talking about. Can I come? And they were fantastic in those days. They were great events, and it was a beautiful balance, really, between the social and the professional. We were all learning. We were all learning from each other, but we also had a really good crack as well. So it's...
Number eight, sense.
This was sort of looking at the sort of our... the contribution to our senses. It's quite interesting. Although noise is often cited as being the most sort of, you know, biggest nuisance for people in a workplace, it is, I understand, the only sense that you can actually, your brain can actually mask. The others, we're just sort of, you know, we're stuck with whatever comes at them. In particular, I'm interested in smell, actually, in that respect, because the sort of association through the limbic system that it has with sort of positive or negative memories, you know, the minute we catch a particular scent, our mind is usually transported back to another place or another time. And so what, you know, we haven't really started even really experimenting with that in a workplace yet. In retail, you know, pumping out the coffee and the fresh bread, I love the story. I think it's Southwest Airlines, where they used to give people a full breakfast on their early morning flights in the States, and as a cost-cutting measure, just went back to sort of bake, you know, the last little phase of baking some chocolate chip cookies on the plane instead. And they found that their customers absolutely loved it, and people were taking the flights because there was nothing better than the smell of fresh baked chocolate chip cookies on a plane in the morning when you got up at 4 o'clock and, you know, and you're on this flight. And that was actually as a budget measure, not as a sort of, hey, let's all sit around and think of great things we can do for our customers. That was a, you know, a way of stopping having to cook full breakfast. So, you know, I think that in some fields, scent is very clearly something that's very important in the workplace terms. You know, if I ever ask a group of people, well, you know, who's got a workplace that smells lovely, and no one ever puts their hand up. And the other sort of one is touch, is creating textured workplace physical spaces as well. It's, you know, a lot of time we just paint surfaces and they're very flat, and it's actually the ability to interact with that space somehow. So I think there's more we can do in that area, and I think we just have to be aware of everything we're doing does have a direct sensory contribution. So it's recognising it and understanding it and making sure we understand the best ways to get something out of that.
For digital workplaces, I think the third-party produced products, you know, the idea of providing design that isn't ugly is kind of now understood. When it comes to internal business systems, there's still a long way to go. There's just no excuse now for ugly applications, and yet so many still are. But interestingly, one of the clients I'm working at the moment, they're rolling out Microsoft Surface laptops, and they have this Alcantara finish, which is it's slightly sort of velvety, carpety kind of feel. And it's really interesting the reaction that gets from people, because it's very unlike what you'd expect a corporate laptop to be like.
Yes.
It is a very sensory thing. Some people actually hate it, but actually the fact that you have that kind of emotional response to the, you know, the material that the thing is made out of.
I was working with a client, they were doing a laptop refresh. I said, why don't you give people a choice of the three colours that the laptops come in? Well, we can't do that. You know, it's like, so why can't you do that? All they have to do is just, it's a common build. You know, all you're doing is giving someone a bit of kit that you've already built, so they can have red, blue, or silver, can't they?
I guess aligned to sense, the idea of comfort, which is number nine.
There's still this huge battle in physical workplace between function and form. It goes back millennia, you know, and still we're still not learning our lessons. There's still a lot of. I still see a lot of physical spaces these days and wonder how the hell anyone thought that someone could use them. And, you know, one of my personal sort of bete noirs is adjacent spaces that nullify each other. So, you know, having two open meeting tables next to each other, well, you're not going to have two meetings going on, because unless you're in a cafe environment where there's a huge amount of white noise, everyone's going to be annoyed by that. I still go into workplaces now and see sort of hot desk benches or open meeting tables next to the quiet areas and think, well, you know, why did you think that was a good idea? Or how are those spaces going to be used? So, you know, just thinking about ergonomics, thinking about the sort of the levels of comfort and then trying to make them beautiful afterwards. So they have to be functional, and then their form can be looked at, and that is the essential order for all of this. And that is the way we arrange spaces, the way we specify work settings, the products we choose. There's, you know, occasionally you might want spaces to be short stay, so you might dial the comfort down a little bit to make sure someone doesn't set up for the day. That's perfectly permissible. But you know, we do have to make sure that we put function first and form second. And I still think our workplace industry, in design terms, still struggles a little bit to make things that are comfortable and ergonomic and supportive and all those things look as good as possible.
Yeah.
You know, we still get straight into the form and forget about that. And the sort of this kind of workshop chic that has arisen over the last 5 or 6 years of furniture that looks like you got it from garden shed and, you know, exposed brickwork and crumbling plaster and the dreaded you know, completely ridiculous filament light bulbs that sort of seem to be everywhere. I mean, they have nothing to do with comfort whatsoever. That is form over function completely.
And again, you see that in the user interface design, I think, particularly. A few years back, the move away from skeuomorphic design. And actually, some of my favourite software is horrendously skeuomorphic because it makes it familiar to me, uncomfortable with it. Music software in particular, where there's a lot of making it look like physical musical instruments, but in digital screen form. But with a lot of business software now, the flat design approach, which actually can make it very difficult to be able to use things. And again, it's a design takes precedent over ergonomics and usability and comfort.
Yeah.
So it's not unusual.
Interestingly, with sort of corporate systems, they were always accompanied by a training program, you know, and so the way they were designed necessitated training, you know, and follow-up and support and all the rest of it. And what was quite interesting in some of the earlier days of some of the more social tools, there were no training courses, there were no instructions. It was a case of sort of feeling your way through it, learning as you went along, you know, you had to sort of effectively, you know, through trial and error, and we all did it, you know, with sort of particularly with Twitter, thinking we were sending a direct message and we sent it to the world. And, you know, so it was a little bit of just sort of teaching ourselves, really, in terms of all of these tools. But so there's always been, to me, this real contrast between the corporate system with its training courses and the entirely intuitive systems that are publicly available. They still seem to be operating in fairly sort of separate worlds in that sense. I don't think I've had a single day's training in any digital social tool whatsoever and still managed to find my way around it.
Inclusion is number 10.
This is really about making sure that a fantastic workplace is fantastic for everybody. Sometimes your best intentioned space design means that someone can't access it, use it properly, and it's usually focused on physical disability because that's where most of the sort of regulations reside and the sort of, you know, the building regulations and those sorts of things, and they're sort of, at the end of the day, they are minimum standards and you always try and exceed those with anything you do. And there's no sort of magic formula to dealing with this. It's just a continual case of thinking design through, layer upon layer, and just making sure that instead of thinking, well, that's fantastic, that's going to be great, you know, well, okay, so let's think through how it's actually going to be used and what the impact is on everyone and the implications are for everyone. And this really is an example of where all of the elements need to come into play together. You know, they're not isolated elements in that sense. They do have a place in the whole.
I think we'll be talking in a few weeks' time with Nancy Doyle, who is a specialist looking at areas of neurodiversity, and she's got interesting things to say about the challenges of neurodiversity and inclusion in comparison to some other areas of inclusion. I think the other element, though, is the digital tools come in. Inclusion based on physical place because the challenge becomes often you will have the bulk of a team sitting in one meeting room and a few others sitting outside.
Yeah.
And how do you have inclusion for people who aren't all in the same place because of the tools that you're using? And yeah, there's some challenges there, and I think that that still is something that people struggle with, because often it means having access to less fidelity to be able to give inclusion to all, and that feels very counterintuitive often. Now, number 11 is the one that I think I'm struggling with most to come to an analogy for digital tools, because it is WASH.
It's most people's sort of area of last resort in a workplace design scheme. I often say that if you really want to know what your what an organisation thinks of its people, go and visit the loo. Because in most instances, as a visitor, you'll go to the reception area and you'll go to the posh meeting room that they've put you in, and you'll go to the toilet. So, you know, and is there a balance between those three spaces in any respect? And there often isn't. It was amazing how many times the condition of toilets cropped up. And they're very simple fixes. They really don't take investment or much thinking about, really. They're actually very straightforward, very simple fixes that make people feel a hell of a lot better about working in that organisation.
Final one then, storage. Yep. And this is interesting because I think actually moves towards increasingly flexible working spaces are meaning that this is the one where actually more than any, the two worlds of digital workplace and physical workplace often coming together and really misaligning, because yes, people aren't provided the physical storage they need for their digital tools.
Interesting one. I think the reason it's in here is because of a sort of changing pattern relating to storage. It used to be rows of paper files, and we had this dream of the paperless office, which never entirely realised. But what we see with well-being programs and sort of, you know, green travel programs and these sorts of things is the need for storage being replaced by sort of other stuff. It's your gym bag, your cycle helmet, your wet clothes, it's your trainers, it's your various pairs of shoes because you'll wear your hiking shoes in the morning. It's the stuff that we're encouraging people to bring into a physical workplace now that we didn't used to, because people just used to bring their briefcase and that was it. And now they're bringing loads of other stuff. And we're expecting people to be a bit more mobile and a bit more agile and be secure that, well, I'm sort of, you know, it's amazing that people just wander around freely with a phone, which is, you know, somewhere between 500 and 800 quid's worth of supercomputer in there, and just wafting it around on the street. But yes, your stuff is valuable and needs to be looked after, and having somewhere to store that is vital. It's also things like, and I've very rarely seen it solved, but you know, when people are packing and unpacking their lockers, there's never a shelf to do it. You see people scrabbling around on the floor trying to sort their stuff out, and then the person, you know, if you walk up to a bank of lockers and there's someone sorting their stuff out, inevitably it's going to be the locker next to yours, even though there might be 100 of these things. It's always the case, you know, and these are just minor details that have never really been worked through. So I think probably the message in relation to digital space is not necessarily to see it literally in terms of storage, it's more to see it in terms of changing patterns of use and behaviours, but also just the need to think through the minutiae and think through every detail.
So having gone through all those, do we think things like digital workplaces exist?
You sent me this challenge a few days ago, and I've been pondering it ever since, and I think they do. But I think that we can, the issue really is that we're always going to be in a physical space. You know, there is, but we're not always going to be in a digital space and using a digital workplace. You know, there will be many things that we will do that will still be quite analog, still be quite personal, or still be quite sort of human, in that sort of face-to-face interactive mode. And so, I do say in the book that I think, you know, the social workplace is the effective combination of the physical and the digital workplace together. And yet there's nothing we can do about the fact that we are always, as a, you know, as a carbon-based unit, going to be in a physical space of some form. So the better that physical space, the better we're likely to feel about our interactions then in a digital space. The more comfortable we are, the more that everything works around us, the more we've thought through that detail, the more we've got control over that environment, you know, the better we're going to be feeling when we're then having those interactions in those digital spaces. you know, we've got a great opportunity to sort of take away the stress and the discomfort and the problems that people might be experiencing, such that they don't then walk into that digital space and with the wrong attitude and wrong approach. So it's important to get both right. Absolutely, their interplay is vital. But you know, at the moment, we've switched everything off and we've exited every system we're ever likely to be interacting with. We're still there in a physical space, and that has to still be right.
So thank you very much, Sunil, for that. And a lot of parallels there, Matt, with some of the workplace discussions we've had on previous episodes of this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, it's a theme that I'm increasingly interested in, and how we need to shift. I mean, from the starting point, one of the things that drives Neil is the fact that he thinks that organisations are really bad at thinking about physical workplace for the most part. And that, you know, facilities management often will manage workplaces ultimately to be able to make it as easy as possible for facilities management to manage the workplace. And workplace designers will design places that workplace designers would like to be in. And the end result is something that's no use to anybody. And similarly, IT organisations still bias towards the idea of providing services that are deliverable and manageable, not necessarily usable. I'm seeing that in a few clients at the moment where, you know, ultimately the technology decisions are being made on expediency of how it will be delivered technically above all else. And we've got to change that mindset, and we've got to start thinking about how do we provide places, whether that's physical or digital, that enable people to work effectively, but also not to try to over-design that either. And that's the other thing. This is kind of long history within IT development, which isn't about producing organic places where the organisation can thrive. It's about producing mechanistic places which can be made able to drive efficiency and effectiveness through repeated process, which isn't thinking about people at all. That thinks about machines. It's about the production line. It's those industrial models about how you turn a workplace into something even more streamlined by factoring out people.
It is. But isn't that the whole point, really? You've got trying to produce something which is completely flexible and is expensive. So whether you're doing it in a physical sense, where it's saying, well, you know, whatever, we've got four floors on this building, and wherever you work in this building, you can have whatever furniture you want. So you don't have to have the same furniture as downstairs. You don't have to have the same layout. Just go for it. Put the whatever furniture you want. And then something happens to the business, and this department grows, and that department shrinks, and then you suddenly, well, we need to make some more space, so we'll move you guys upstairs. But that furniture upstairs isn't your furniture. So you end up with a quite an inflexible solution that was suitable on the day that you did it. And I think the same goes for digital workspaces, because you are then allowing people to mold things in their own way, which isn't necessarily compatible with the needs of the organization or the needs of the collective. Now, I know that what happens is, of course, you get everybody's second choice. You kind of get this compromise, but it is manageable. And whilst I understand that it's not necessarily the best way to do it from a business point of view, sadly, it can be the only way you can afford to do it.
Yeah, I think though that there's two things with what Neil was talking about. The first is that actually he's trying to identify small, easy fixes, and the framework is there for people to be able to identify in physical spaces what, you know, might be missing and what can they tweak to make better. I think the other thing is actually now the idea of the corporate interest taking precedent over the end user's interests is gone. And if you think about physical workspace, you know, a lot of us spend our time not bothering using the things that are provided by companies, not just because we're working independently, but just because it's often easier to do so. We meet in coffee bars, we meet in places other than the office, often when we're contracted by companies who, you know, you can never find a bloody meeting room in most of these offices to be able to meet in. You end up working in communal spaces, maybe inside or outside of the building. And similarly, I think that's been the trend that we've seen with consumerization of tools, and why things like WhatsApp have become so successful. It's because they give control to the user and they're easy and simple to use, so we use them. And there's risk, and I think that most people are doing it with their eyes open on it. I don't think it's being done entirely stupidly.
Well, exactly. People can make their own decisions, can't they? And I think I think what you are saying about the corporate need is more about, in my mind, people taking personal responsibility, and that responsibility being kind of vested in them as how they achieve what they're set out to, what they're set out to do.
So anyway, I think there's Neil's book's definitely worth a read, and if you're looking at sort of collaborative platforms and whatever, I think it's a really interesting way to think about how you might provide those digital workplaces, because it gives you a way of thinking about it that's is quite different from traditional sort of IT mindset. We'll put a link to Neil's website and his book on wb40podcast.com, and it was a pleasure chatting to him. So there we go, another episode comes to a beautiful conclusion. Busy week ahead?
Another one, of course, yes, lots going on, and looking forward to, as we head towards episode 80, and when we get to what will be our 2-year anniversary, Matt.
Yes, next month, isn't it? I can't remember exactly the date, but at some point in October we will be celebrating 2 years.
It'll be 80, 81, something like that, where we get to 2 years, which is a remarkable achievement. We'll have to do something special for that.
Absolutely. Good-o. Well, thank you for joining us, and hope that you enjoyed it. And we look forward to speaking to you next week. Follow us on Twitter at WB40Podcast. You can find us at WB40Podcast.com. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, and all good podcasting platforms. Give us a review, because we really would like it. Thank you.